In the next session, we're going to talk about how to make a universe. Just think for a moment that it's 6,000 years ago. So you're the same mind-body physiology that you are right now, but we haven't yet invented things like fax machines and cellular telephones and automobiles and periodic atomic tables, and we haven't heard yet of Newton or Einstein. Yet we have a curious mind, and we want to understand what is the meaning of life, what is this universe that we are a part of. And the great Vedic sages looked into their own awareness and cognized this scheme, which has really profound significance even 5, 8, 10,000 years later. We use Ayurveda as our framework. Ayur comes from the Sanskrit word ayus, which means life. Veda comes from the Sanskrit word vid, which means science or knowledge. Our word wisdom, comes from that root vid. So Ayurveda is the science of life. It's not the science of modern life. It's not the science of ancient life. It's not the science of Indian life. It's the science of life. It's not an alternative medical system. It's the science of life. And so whatever is true in this timeless tradition is true because it was true then, it's true now, it should be true again in the future. And so when we look at Ayurveda, we don't really look at it so much as it's another system of healing like acupuncture, oriental medicine, Tibetan medicine, chiropractic, homeopathy, pharmacological medicine. Because the value that we find of Ayurveda is providing a framework onto which every other system of healing can easily find a home and allows for a common vocabulary so that healthcare providers, healers, teachers, educators can communicate with each other. And that's really what we see as the value of Ayurveda. So we're going to talk a little bit about how the universe is created from an Ayurvedic model. This is a very abstract session, and I would just encourage you to not strain about it. So just listen. Whatever goes in, goes in. We'll go over it again several times. You're not supposed to get it the first time around. I'm not sure if I've gotten it the 100th time around. So just be easy with it. Again, the basic premise of Ayurveda is that consciousness is primary, matter is secondary. It's really the reverse of what we were raised with up until quantum physics became a more predominant paradigm. So 25 years ago, if you asked a neuroscientist what is awareness, they would say it's some byproduct of these molecules in nerve cells colliding with each other and creating this experience of thought, but we don't understand it. But we believe that the molecular structures of the universe are what are responsible for these higher level functions. Ayurveda would say that the opposite is true, that we are not physical beings with occasional experiences of consciousness, but we are fields of consciousness with occasional physical experiences. That the entire universe is really a network of energy and information and intelligence, of which we are a part. And this energy and information has learned how to organize itself into this disguise of matter. But it's a disguise. If you look at this body, it looks like it has edges. But we know that between every atom in my body, between the electron and nucleus of every atom in my body, is a space that's as vast as between the galaxies. And that even those little particles, that electron and that neutron, When you look at it close enough, it disappears into a field of probability amplitudes. So our senses lock and freeze these changing dynamic patterns of energy and information into this temporary illusion of stability. But it's just an illusion. It's Maya. We've created it, but it's not its essential nature. So consciousness is primary. And the question asked is, well, how does consciousness do such a good job at creating this illusion? Why can't I walk through that wall if it's just consciousness? And so Ayurveda looked at that and came up with a beautiful scenario of how we create reality. In Sanskrit, it's known as Sankhya, which means enumeration. It just means that process of quantifying reality, quantifying the unquantifiable. So we start with something that we can't even begin with because it really has no beginning. The word is avyakta in Sanskrit, but we can just call it the unmanifest, which is the closest word we have to something that really can't allow any word to be applied to it. How do we describe the indescribable? We say it's indescribable. How do we describe the unmanifest? We say it's unmanifest. Within the unmanifest, according to Ayurveda, there are these two qualities, two forces, two essential concepts. These are really still entirely in the realm of consciousness. There's nothing to show for it. We can't prove it. We infer it. But it's just an idea. And what are those concepts? One is the concept of pure being, known as Purusha. Pure being means it never manifests, it never wants to manifest, it never will manifest, it's unmanifest. It's the unmanifest part of the unmanifest that never has any interest in manifesting. Okay? Totally happy in being non-existent. Now, if that's all there was, we wouldn't be here. So fortunately for us, there's another part of the unmanifest called Prakriti, which is that creative potential. It's the part of the unmanifest that actually would like to manifest. Unlike Purusha, which is quite comfortable just being totally in the abstract, Purusha, although it is totally abstract, would like to at some point become less abstract. So it's that part of creation, part of consciousness, part of spirit that has the impulse to create. So what does it do when it creates? So here you are the unmanifest. You're even before God. Okay? So you're just unmanifest. There's a part of you says, oh, let's just stay here. The other part says, no, let's go somewhere. No, let's just stay here. No, let's go somewhere. So the part that wants to go somewhere, Prakriti, creative potential, begins. So it creates. What does it create? It creates awareness. So it's awareness, the state of awareness. Up until this point, there's no awareness because it's completely unmanifest. There's just this impulse to awareness. Now there's awareness. That awareness is called Mahat, great, like Mahatma Gandhi, the greatness. It's that awareness of cosmic intelligence. What is it aware of? Itself. There's nothing else to be aware of. All it has so far is that spur towards awareness. That's the state that we go into when we go into the gap. We go beyond any forms and phenomenon. We just go into awareness. We're awake. Awake of what? Just awake of my own awakeness. When the Buddha became enlightened, people asked him, well, what are you? Are you a messiah? Are you a prophet? Are you a god? He said, I am just aware. I'm just aware. So that experience of the creative potential becoming aware is this expression of cosmic intelligence, Mahat. One step further into manifestation, we become aware of the fact that we exist. And in that first step of awareness of existence, we begin to assume possession. I exist. First, there's just pure existence. There is no I. But when we reach this point of manifestation, then consciousness becomes aware of its own consciousness. Consciousness becomes conscious. Awareness becomes aware. And in that process is the birth of the ego. Ahankara means the I former. Ahankara, the former of the I, the creator of the I. So that's when that sense of possession dawns. We spend the rest of our lives in this realm. That's my body. Those are my toys. Mommy, he's eating my dinner. That's my business. That's my girlfriend. The ego is continuously attempting to gain authority. And so is the nature of consciousness. So we have the dawning of ego. Now, the ego is said to have these three qualities: creation, maintenance, and dissolution. Generation, operation, destruction. With the birth of the ego comes the birth of time. With the birth of time comes time-space reality, meaning beginning, middle, end. There's nothing that we can perceive that doesn't have a beginning and a middle and an end to it. The beginning in Ayurveda is known as sattva, that creative force, that force that wants to create, wants to generate new beginnings all the time, new beginnings, new beginnings, new beginnings. The maintenance, which is often involved in transformation, is known in Sanskrit as rajas, rajas. And then that dissolution, that coming back down to unmanifest state, is known as tamas. But of course, anytime there's dissolution, there's automatically recreation. So in the transformation of a rosebud to a rose, the rose is being created at the same time that the bud is being destroyed. And that's true on everything. Every step along the way, there's creation, maintenance, dissolution. I once had a dream that I was in this very ethereal place along this beautiful shoreline. And at first I didn't think there was anything in the sand, but then I started to see that within the sand, these human-looking beings were emerging and then dissolving back into the sand, emerging and dissolving back into the sand. And what I saw was these sand mothers giving birth and at the same time bringing their babies back into the sand, bringing back into the sand. And I had this image of this hand of God at the same time that it clips the umbilical cord, giving rise to a new life. It's pinching off the airway of the previous death. This continuous cycle of birth, death, rebirth, death. It's the nature of time to provide us with that experience. If that's all we know, then welcome to the land of suffering. But if we understand that beyond that field of change is this eternal field of non-change, then welcome to the land of bliss. And that's really the goal of Ayurveda, is to tolerate the ambiguity of the ever-changing universe on the field of a non-changing reality. One of the most brilliant things that I think Sigmund Freud ever said was that neurosis is the inability to tolerate ambivalence. So we're all basically neurotic. It's very hard to tolerate this ambivalence of being a localized human being with our intentions and desires and aspirations and hopes and wishes for personal fulfillment, at the same time knowing increasingly that we're really exactly the same as every other human being and every other manifestation on this planet. That ability to go from the unbounded to the bounded is really the definition of enlightenment, and that's really the goal of Ayurveda. Another way of saying this is that in the very process of manifesting, this unity value of unmanifest creation divides into this threefold division of the knower, the process of knowing, and that which is known. Previously, there was nothing. Then there was the knower. But then as soon as the knower became aware of its own existence, what did the knower know? It knew itself. And in that process of knowing itself, the one became the many. We can say it in a different way. The seer, the scenery, in the process of seeing. The lover, the beloved, in the process of loving. Everything that we experience is on the basis of this threefold division. But we know that these three aspects are just different disguises of this unmanifest consciousness. Now, we've gotten to this very abstract level. Can we bring it down to earth? How do we perceive reality? What is reality? According to Ayurveda, reality is the simultaneous creation of objects and the ability to perceive that object. There's the age-old question, if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, was there any sound? Ayurveda asks that same question. And so in the Ayurvedic model of creating a universe, it describes a simultaneous development of both that which can be perceived and the ability to perceive it. So for each level of perception, there's something there to perceive. If we had eyes and there was no light, there wouldn't be that reality. If we had ears but no sound, there wouldn't be that reality. So the five sense perceptions are there to perceive the reality that's created at the same time. So let's talk about the five organs. These are known as the gyanendriyas, the sensory organs. It's how we ingest the universe. We ingest sound through our ears, touch through our skin, visual stimuli through our eyes, taste through our tongue, and scent through our nose. That's how we know about reality. If we closed off all those organs of perception, we wouldn't know that there was anything out there. But what is it that we perceive? We perceive the objects that send us impulses to those organ systems. We perceive sound, touch, sight, taste, and smell. These are considered to be the subtle elements. The whole universe is said to be structured by means of these subtle elements. If it doesn't come to us through sound, touch, sight, taste, and smell, we don't experience it. Now, where does the sound, touch, sight, taste, and smell come from? It comes from the great elements. The great elements. And these are the five great elements. They're known as the Maha Bhutas, the five great elements. Space, air, fire, water, and earth. So when we're talking about what's out there, this is what Ayurveda says is out there. Space, air, fire, water, and earth. We perceive those five elements by means of the five subtle elements through our five sense organs. So space sends us information through the sense of sound. Sound travels through space. Touch receives information from the air element. The air element can also be thought of as wind. It's space in movement. Fire element is perceived through the sense of sight. Water element is perceived through the sense of taste. And earth element is perceived through the sense of smell. So according to Ayurveda, everything in the universe can be broken down into its components of space, air, fire, water, and earth. So let's talk about those in more detail. Space is the potentiality for expression. Look around you right now. Don't look at the objects. Look at the space between the objects. The space is always here. Objects may come and go within that space, but the space remains. You can take down the walls, you can break down the floors, you can eliminate the ceilings, we can all leave, but this space is the eternal background for which all other experiences occur. Space is this pure potentiality. Deepak will be talking about how space may very well be spirit. It's omnipresent, it's eternal, it's always witnessing. And if you just put your attention on space, just put your attention in the space between objects, you will notice there's some presence there. The space between objects, the space between thoughts, the space between breaths, it's the same space. It's everywhere. It's the potential for everything else. Space. Air represents the ability to move. Air, think of as the wind. As soon as we envision space, we envision moving through that space. Think about the opening scene from Star Trek. You can't look at those stars out there without having some intention of moving through that star. So anything in the universe that has the quality of movement in it is said to be a quality of air, this movement element. So air represents the principle of movement in the universe. Space represents the principle of potential. Air represents the principle of movement. Fire represents the principle of transformation, of change, conversion from one state to another. So if we take water and we apply fire, it changes into a gaseous state. If we take ice and apply fire, it changes into another state. If we apply fire to a log in the fireplace, we create heat. If we apply fire in our bodies, we metabolize food. So fire is the element that's constantly transforming. It's changing the level of movement. And just as air is inherent within the quality of space, fire is inherent within the qualities of air. Because what is fire? Fire is just molecules moving against each other. So things begin to move, that's the air element. And they move and start bumping into each other, starting to create friction, that creates the heat element, the element of fire. So fire is an intrinsic property of air. What we're doing is taking this completely abstract field of consciousness and densifying it, consolidating it. We're bringing the unmanifest into the manifest through these five codes of intelligence known as the five great elements. So we have space, we have air, we have fire. The next element is water. Water is the principle of cohesion. Water is that which keeps things together. If you take a bowl of brownie mix, it's just that powdery flour, you throw water in it, it causes it to consolidate. Water represents any of the attractive forces in the universe. So gravity is a force of water. Electromagnetism is a force of water. The strong nuclear forces in an atom are the forces of water. So water is that principle that brings things together. It's closely connected with community. What's the most intimate thing we do with people? We share fluids. Kissing. Sexual fluids. Sweating. Water is that which brings things together. The cohesive principle of life. And then the fifth element, the final element, is earth. Earth means matter. Solid, structured matter. All the other elements are really not necessarily fixed in time and space. Space is really unfixed. Air has some position in space, but very little localization in time. Fire is temporarily fixed in time, but it's constantly changing. Its shape is constantly changing. Water is fairly fixed in space, but again, it's constantly changing. Earth is that illusion of consciousness that holds its shape for at least some period of time. As the cohesive forces of water get stronger and stronger and stronger, the individual particles of reality end up getting so close that they give the illusion of structure. So we know that even a solid chunk of lead, which looks so massive, is mostly empty space. It's those cohesive forces that give this illusion of the earth element being temporarily consolidated. Okay, so let's look at it from the perspective of modern science. It seems so simple. How could it really have any relevance today? We know that the periodic table has several hundred elements. How is it that we can define the entire universe in terms of these five basic principles? Let's look at the current model of the fundamental structure of matter according to modern physics, which is the atom. So, where do we find these five elements? Space. Well, we've been telling you since the first time you ever heard Deepak that 99.99% of matter is empty space. Now, it's almost all empty space, and even the little part of it that looks solid still is mostly emptiness. So clearly, the modern model of an atom includes within it this concept of space. Where is the principle of movement? Movement is air. So movement, of course, in the older model, it's the movement of the electrons around the nucleus. In the newer model, it's the fluctuations in the quantum field of the electron states. But we know that movement is an essential feature of reality, and that's represented in this air element. Where do we see the principle of fire, of energy, of transformation? Well, of course, it's the energy that's inherent in this conversion between mass and energy. You know, E equals mc squared. We know that there's a tremendous amount of energy locked up in every atom, which is why we get so worried when the North Koreans or Saddam Hussein seem to be trying to tap into that energy. So energy is an essential aspect of our current model of the universe. Where do we see the principle of water, of cohesion? Well, obviously, it's what keeps the atom together. The electromagnetism that keeps the negative electron from flying off from the positively charged center of the nucleus of the atom. It's the strong nuclear forces in the center of the atom. So these cohesive forces are an essential aspect of our model of the universe. And where do we find the principle of Earth? Well, it's these individual particles, protons and neutrons and electrons, and if we want to go deeper, then the quarks and the elementary particles. So in our model, in our complicated quantum mechanical model of the universe, we still find these five elements in their principal form, and there's really nothing that falls outside of those five elements. So it's elegant. It's simple and it's elegant. Where do we find the five elements in our biological model? What's the fundamental unit of biology? The cell. So if this is a practical science, then we should be able to localize these five codes of intelligence into our modern biological model. Because again, if it's timeless, it shouldn't matter that we're 5,000 years later than when it was first elaborated. So where are the five elements? So where's the element of space? Space can be seen as the pores in the membrane. Now, it's emptiness. There's nothing there, but it's essential to life. Through these pores in the membranes, salts, water transport themselves. Molecules from the outside come through and interact with molecules on the inside. If you close off those pores in the membrane, life will not survive. So the emptiness is an essential feature of life. Where do we find the principle of movement, of air? Well, life is movement, continuously moving. We're zipping and unzipping DNA molecules. We're creating messenger RNA, which is floating in the cytoplasm and reaching the protein factories, the ribosomes, We have elements flowing in and out of the cell, glucose, oxygen. It's a continuous movement, a continuous exchange of gases, of energy, of information. Stop the movement, life stops. So clearly movement is an essential feature of our biological model. Where do we find the cohesive value of water? Well, we know water is absolutely essential to life. It's what keeps this bag of proteins, sugars, carbohydrates together. Dry out the water, life lasts for a very short time. We can go weeks without eating. We can only go a couple days without drinking before life dissolves. So that water element is really what keeps life flowing. And Earth are these individual particles, which many people haven't thought about since their biology days. You know, the nucleus, the ribosomes, the liposomes, the mitochondria. Mitochondria are really the fire factories of the cell. It's where we constantly transform energy. So we have all five elements there. Space in the pores, air in the movement, fire in the mitochondria, the metabolism of fats and carbohydrates and proteins, water in the cohesive value, earth in the different organelles within the system. Everything that we can think of can fall within one of these categories. There's nothing that we can think of that doesn't fall within one of those categories. So it's timeless wisdom. Simple model. It really helps us to begin to look at the world in a very intimate way. And we'll be talking about how this translates into intimacy in just a few moments. So just to review, the entire universe is structured by these five elements: space, air, fire, water, earth. Each of our senses is designed primarily to extract the information that one of those five elements carries from the universe. So our hearing is primarily designed to bring in information from space. Our skin is primarily structured to bring in information from air. In the way that air, wind blows against your face. Again, movement. How do we perceive things with our sense of touch? It's always in terms of some distortion of a touch receptor in our skin. It moves it, it pushes it, twists it in some way, and that's how we perceive movement. How do we perceive the fire element? Through our eyes. The entire evolution of the eye was really the development of a way to follow the sunshine. The first development of the eye, millions and millions of years ago, was just some localized patch of pigment on the skin of some primitive organism that eventually, over millions of years, led to the development of these very sophisticated visual receptors. How do we perceive water? Through our sense of taste. That's really how we bring water into our physiology, through the sense of taste. And how do we perceive earth? Through the sense of smell. Throughout most of our existence, we had our nose very closely related to the sense of smell. It's the most important way that nature has of telling us at a distance whether or not something is nourishing or toxic to us. If it doesn't smell very good, it's probably not something that we want. So those are the five elements. Now, there's also this concept in Ayurveda of the action organ. So how do we act on these five elements? It's a little bit less intuitively obvious, but we'll just review it for completeness. How do we act on a sound element? Human beings act by making sounds, usually vocal. So our speech apparatus is the way that we create sound. We can do it other ways, snap our fingers, clap our hands, stomp our feet. Our dogs do it by barking, our cats do it by meowing. We can play musical instruments, we can blow across Coke bottles or reeds or flutes, we can chant. For the most part, our vocal apparatus is the way that we make sound. We transmit information across space through sound. So if I want to listen to the radio station from Los Angeles, I will tune in. If I want to call in and argue with Dr. Laura, I'll do it through my sense of sound. How do we act upon the sense of touch? With our hands. Okay, so that's how we touch people. How do we act upon the element of sight? It's a little bit less obvious. In Ayurveda, it said that we do that through our limbs. So it makes some sense. You want to get someone's attention across space, you move. Dancers move, which attracts our sense of sight. So it's through our movement that we end up encouraging visual attention. It's not quite as obvious as some of the other ones. The same is true for the element of water. That it's said that we act upon the element water through reproductive fluids. So the ovum and the fluid that carries the ovum, the sperm and the fluid that carries the sperm, it's the way that we act upon that water element. And then finally, the means that we have to act upon the element of earth is to eliminate. And certainly we know that that's true, that basically what our waste products go back into the earth, nourish the soil, give rise to the next generation of growth. So, more importantly than worrying about the action organs, we need to know the five elements, space, air, fire, water, earth, know the five ways that we have of perceiving those five elements, and understand the basic principles that those five elements represent. They're not elements in the sense of, here's an element of lead, here's an element of gold. They're these vast, broad principles of understanding, similar to modern physics' understanding of the four basic forces of nature: electromagnetism, gravity, strong and weak interactive forces. These forces explain everything that's going on in the world. In a similar way, these five elements are these basic codes that nature uses to organize the outer environment and the inner environment. And although this seems very abstract, in the next session we'll show you how really practical this knowledge is and how it provides a framework to begin to understand the remarkable healing interventions of Ayurveda and how we can really understand healing modalities from every possible health science within the context of these five basic elements. One of the unique and really valuable aspects of applying Ayurvedic principles to healing is the recognition that people are different. That there isn't, in Ayurveda, there is not the expression that one size fits all. And that the more that we can understand the nature of the person that we are attempting to help, the more effective we'll be in whatever interventions we offer. As a Western physician, when I learned about diagnosis, primarily what I learned was to understand thoroughly the nature of the disease. So whether or not it was multiple sclerosis or muscular dystrophy or Parkinson's, when I studied the disease. In Ayurveda, there is a clear recognition of the importance of understanding the disease, but of equal importance is the understanding of the person who has the disease. And so in Ayurveda, diagnosis means thoroughly knowing the person who is out of balance and as a result is susceptible to some disease process. These basic principles that we talked about of space, air, fire, water, and earth begin to give us an understanding of how to characterize our uniqueness. We're all made up of the same stuff. Ultimately, we're all consciousness disguising itself. At the next level, we are consciousness disguising itself as the five elements. And then we'll see in this session how these five elements can combine into a variety of different expressions that begin to determine our uniqueness. So, according to Ayurveda, these five basic elements, we haven't used the Sanskrit terms. They're useful to at least hear. The Sanskrit term for space is akasha. Akasha. Sometimes if you read Ayurvedic books, you'll see space also referred to as ether, pretty much interchangeably. So, akasha is space, that expansion element. The air element in Ayurveda, in Sanskrit, is known as vayu, that principle of movement. The fire element is known as tejas, principle of transformation, of metabolism. The water element is known as jala, principle of cohesion, and the earth element is known as prithvi, principle of mass, of structure. So akasha, vayu, tejas, jala, prithvi, but we'll stick with space, air, fire, water, and earth. Now, according to Ayurvedic theory, these five elements in biological systems, particularly in human biological systems, combine to form the three mind-body principles. This is a Sanskrit word that you should know. The word is dosha. Dosha. The five elements combine to form three doshas. The first dosha is combined of the elements of space and air. And it's known as vata. Vata. The second element is primarily composed of fire, though it has a little bit of water in it. That's known as pitta. Not pitta like the bread, but pitta. And the third element is composed of water and earth, and it's known as kapha. We don't have a good translation for these words in English. Sometimes when we're doing a very straight presentation, we talk about it as movement, transformation, and structure. Sometimes you'll hear them referred to as air, fire, and earth. For the purposes of this course, let's use the Sanskrit. Vata, pitta, kapha. Say it together. Vata, pitta, kapha. So, space and air make up vata. Fire and water make up pitta. Water and earth make up kapha. So, without knowing anything else, which dosha would you predict would be the heaviest? Kapha, because it's made up of earth and water. Which dosha would you predict would be the lightest? Vata, space and air. There's not much lighter than that. Which dosha would you predict would be the hottest? Pitta. Okay. So if you understand the elements that compose the dosha, it'll be very easy for you to remember and ultimately to cognize all the qualities of these three mind-body principles as they function within our bodies. Within the human physiology, these five elements dance together in the form of these three doshas and determine the functioning of every aspect of our minds and our bodies. So let's go into it in more detail. Vata dosha. Vata will have the qualities that would be predicted on the basis of something that's made up entirely of space and air. It's going to be dry because air dries things. Right? In the old days, we'd put our sheets up on the laundry line and the wind would dry it. It's cold. Even on a hot summer day, if you're wet and the wind blows, it's going to cool you off. If you go up to higher atmospheres into space, it's going to be cold. That's why the airplanes get cold at 30,000 feet. It's light. Both air and space are intrinsically light. Their tendency is to rise. It's irregular. Here we're really talking about air element as being the wind. Are there any sailors in the group? Any sailor remembers and knows that the wind is unpredictable. It'll come, it'll go, it'll come, it'll go. That's the nature of vata. It's always changing. It's mobile. It's movable. Nothing really moves except that the wind is blowing it. So you can see leaves being carried across your yard, but the leaves aren't moving. It's the wind that's pushing those leaves. So it has a mobile quality. It's quick. It changes rapidly. And it's roughening. Nothing like a sandstorm blowing through to roughen up the situation. If the air is drying out your skin, it's causing a roughness there. So these are the essential qualities of vata, wherever it functions in the body. The way to think about pitta is it's like a chemical fire. It's like an acid. It's fire within the media of water. And so it's a chemical fire. And it has these qualities. Of course, since it's fiery, it's hot. It's moist because of the water element. It's still light. Fire is light. It still tends to cause things to rise. When you add heat to something, it tends to lighten it. It's quite intense. It tends to be penetrating, like a fire that's moving through a forest. It's fluid, and many of the digestive fluids are really pitta, bile, stomach acid. They're this fluid fire that helps to digest things. It's pungent, meaning it has a spicy effect when you taste it. And it tends to be sour. again, it's like a chemical fire. Almost all of the sour things that we put into our bodies are acids on some level. Citric acid, ascorbic acid, vinegar, which is acetic acid. These are all acidic qualities as a result of this fire and water, and it has that sour taste to us. So that's the Pitta dosha, the principle of conversion. And then finally, the Kapha dosha. So it's heavy, it's mass, it's tissue. Vata is more physiological. In fact, as we'll learn, it's really more the flow of information based often in the nervous system. Pitta is metabolic, transformational. It's what allows us to digest and metabolize, mostly in the digestive system. Kapha, composed of earth and water, has structure to it, mass, flesh. So it's cold. We know that the earth is cold and water is cold. Just need to go down a little bit into it and you'll experience that coldness. It's heavy. Unlike fire and air, which keep rising, earth and water stay down. They tend to create heaviness. It's much more stable. Earth provides that stability, that structure, that form. It's viscous, meaning even when it flows more slowly, like honey or molasses. It's dense, although there's still a lot of space between the atoms. They're closer together than they are in the Vata dosha or the Pitta dosha. It has a smoothing effect, and it moves slowly. So these are the basic qualities of each of the three doshas, and we'll see now how they express themselves throughout the physiology. Anything that has to do with movement in our minds or our bodies is said to be governed by Vata dosha. So movement of thought, movement of activity, movement of food, movement of circulation, movement of elimination. Anything that's moving in the body is said to be under the jurisdiction of Vata. Now, we've come back a couple times now to this concept of balance. Everything that's moving should be moving at a certain pace. It can move too quickly, in which case it can lead to imbalance. It can move too slowly, in which case it can lead to imbalance. So with every dosha, with every principle, the goal is to find what is its correct pattern, its correct rhythm, its correct cycle, and to reestablish that if we've lost that rhythm. So in the mind, we want the Vata dosha to be present to govern that creative thought process. If Vata is too dull, then we won't have any new thoughts. If Vata is too active, then our minds will be racing. We'll have anxiety or insomnia. Vata tends to get overly abundant, so that when Vata becomes accumulated in the physiology, it will manifest often as excessive thoughts. Vata is responsible for activity, how quickly we move. You'll see it. Just look at the dinner table. There's some people eating as quickly as possible. They're moving all the time. Their eyes are moving. Their face is moving. Their hands are moving. Other people are moving very slowly. Vata is what governs that movement behavior. Vata is responsible for the movement of respiration, movement in and out of the breath. The breath and the mind are intimately connected. As soon as breath stops, the mind stops. When the mind is agitated, the breath is agitated. When the mind is quiet, the breath is quiet. That movement of breath is an important function of Vata. Vata governs the movement of food through the gastrointestinal system. Food goes into our mouth, Vata moves it down through our esophagus, gets into our stomach. Vata is responsible for the churning. When it's ready, moves through our small intestine, ultimately out the system through elimination. So any movement throughout the entire digestive tract is a reflection of Vata dosha. And finally, it's responsible for circulation of the blood, the movement of blood cells, plasma, and all the hormones and substances contained traveling throughout, coming back. That's all within Vata. So if someone is having a problem with some element of movement in their system, from an Ayurvedic perspective, it means they're having some problems with Vata dosha. Either too much, which is the usual pattern, or sometimes too little. Pitta dosha, fire and water. When you think about fire, there's two components. Heat and light. And so in the physiology, pitta, that fire element, is responsible for anything that has to do with heat and light. Heat being primarily transformation, metabolism. Light being vision, coloration. Pitta is responsible for mental discrimination. When we're deciding, it's pitta that's at work, trying to make these fine discriminations. The way to think about it is that it's the light of consciousness shining on something that allows us to see the fine details that enable us to discriminate. You know, if you're in a dark room and you have two socks, one red, one green, you're not going to be able to discriminate. It's only with the light that allows you to see the fine details. So pitta in the mind is the aspect of the mind that allows us to discriminate in fine details. It's responsible for the entire realm of visual perception. What is pitta? Pitta is the transformation of light into other forms of energy. So when I look into that light, what's happening? Photons from that source, from that fire source, are traveling across space, resonating with the chemistry in the back of my eye, in the cones and rods. That's creating a chemical transformation which sets up an electrical signal, which is a fiery element, traveling through the nerve cells, reaches a part of my thalamus, the lateral geniculate, creates another chemical transformation, sends another electrical discharge, stimulating nerve cells in my occipital cortex, the visual part of the brain, spreads out other parts of my brain, say, oh, that shape, that sound, that sight, it's a light bulb. That whole process is said to be under the governance of pitta, transformation of light energy. Pitta is intensely responsible for digestion. Digestion of food. What is the digestion of food? What happens when we digest food is we take a package of energy and information from the outside. It's a banana. What is a banana? It's a package of energy and information. We put it into our bodies. Our pitta goes to work on it, breaking it down into its basic elements. It's fire, air, water, earth, space. Then my pitta goes back to work at recreating it. So this banana that was a banana yesterday, today is part of my liver or part of my muscle cells. That process of digestion is the process of breaking down and then reformulating these five basic elements into a new form that's useful to us and extracting the energy that we need to carry on our daily behaviors. As we'll talk, digestion in Ayurveda doesn't just mean digestion of food. If this is the first time you've heard me talk about pitta, then your mental pitta is digesting these ideas. It's trying to break it down into other concepts that you've heard before, trying to discriminate, trying to absorb certain things, trying to reformulate a new mental body that now includes this new type of mental tissue. So we're constantly digesting the universe, and pitta is that element that governs that digestion. It's responsible for coloration. Pretty much anything in the body that has color or pigment to it is governed by pitta. So the blood, which is red and hot, is governed by pitta. The muscles, which have myoglobin in it, another pigmented substance, is governed by pitta. The bile, which is green, the stomach acid, which is yellow, has pitta to it. So almost anything in the body that has a color in the red, yellow, orange family is under the function of pitta and reflects some digestive process. And finally, pitta is responsible for regulating our temperature. What an amazing thermostat we carry within us, right? It can be 50 degrees outside, we maintain a core temperature of 98.6. It can be 102 degrees outside, we maintain a core temperature. So it's that pitta, that fire element, which turns on the furnace when it's getting too cold, turns down the furnace when it's getting too hot. Pitta governs that metabolic functioning that maintains a constant temperature. Okay. And kapha, earth and water, provides structure. The earth element provides structure with water. The water element provides lubrication. So kapha is really responsible for anything in the body that has to do with structure or lubrication. In the nervous system, kapha is responsible for cooling off and nurturing. So it really governs the production, the circulation of cerebral spinal fluid. It's responsible for the perception of taste. You know, if you dry your tongue out, you know, sit with your tongue out of your mouth for a couple minutes and then put something on it, you won't be able to taste it. Because it's that water element that allows for these little tasty chemicals to be dissolved and to stimulate the chemical receptors on our tongue. So pitta is intimately involved in the taste perception. It protects our digestive tract. It protects our stomachs from the hydrochloric acid that we use to digest. It protects our respiratory tract so that kapha provides lubrication, the mucus, which protects our respiratory tract. It tends to line our hollow spaces, keeping the fire element and keeping the air element from getting out of balance, doing too strong of its job. Think about what's happening in the stomach. We've talked about all three elements are present there now. The pitta element is secreting stomach acid, that fiery, colored substance. But it's not just sitting there. The vata element is churning it, so it's mixing with the food. And the kapha element is lining the stomach so that this fiery, acidy substance doesn't erode its way through the lining and create an ulcer. Think about what's happening in the heart. The vata element is what's pumping the circulation. The pitta element is the blood that carries that heat and nurturing energy throughout the body. And the kapha element supports the pericardial sac, the fluid around the heart, so it keeps it from overheating. In every aspect of our body, all three of these doshas are present in different balances. So in one place, there may be a predominance of vata, some pitta, less kapha. Another place, there may be another ratio. So it's not that at every place we have equal proportions of all three, but there is an ideal proportion, which when we begin to lose that proportion, sets up the conditions for illness. Kapha is responsible for lubricating our joints. So as we get older and kapha tends to be less in our system, as we get older we'll talk about vata tends to predominate, then our joints get drier, we start to crack, we tend to have more anxiety as the vata moves into the mind, our skin gets drier as vata tends to dry out the skin, we get constipation as vata tends to dry out the digestive tract. So by knowing that at different stages of life, one dosha predominates, we can take actions to try to counterbalance that tendency and reestablish a healthy state. And finally, kapha is responsible for fat and water metabolism, regulating how much water we hold in the system, how much fat we hold in the system, both qualities of kapha. So these are the basic physiological functions. I'm going to take it a step deeper. Each dosha, which is composed of the elements, has within it five subdivisions. How many people right now are already shutting down? Okay. So don't worry about it. Just let it flow through you. If you don't get it all now, that's fine, but don't strain. Okay? Vata has five primary seats where it functions within the physiology. And these are called sub-doshas. Dosha refers to vata, pitta, kapha. And then each of these have five expressions within the physiology. The words are nice. Prana, udana, samana, apana, dhyana. Let's say them together. Prana, udana, samana, apana, dhyana. Okay. So these are the ways that vata governs in the physiology. Prana is primarily responsible for what's happening above the diaphragm. It's responsible for the movement of thought, the mind, and the movement of breath. So that when prana vata is out of balance, it will usually express itself as excessive thoughts, anxiety, insomnia, depression, headaches. It's an expression of prana vata being out of balance. Or it will express itself as bronchitis, upper respiratory infections, asthma. Again, in Ayurveda, the mind and the breath are intimately related. When you're feeling really scared, you stop breathing. When you're breathing easily, your mind is usually functioning in an easy pattern. By just changing your breathing pattern, you can change your mental pattern as well. So prana is the mind and the breath. Udana is a function of udana. Samana is centrally located, and it's responsible for that churning motion throughout the digestive system. Apana is downward moving air. Now, it tends to be the part of vata that starts all the trouble, because it's opposite in value to what would be the nature of vata. Vata, again, is air and space. Which direction does it want to move in? Up. It floats. It's like a helium balloon. But apana is responsible for moving things down and out. It's responsible for moving our bowels, passing wind, releasing menstrual flow, ejaculation, urination, and giving birth. All those movements are bringing it down to earth. So we have something that by its nature wants to rise, responsible for all these behaviors which are to bring things down. So when we get out of balance, when we're stressed, when we're not sleeping well, not eating well, in emotionally distressing situations, one of the first things that tends to happen is that apana gets confused. And instead of moving downwards, it starts to move upwards. And the result of that can range from anything like constipation, which is common in people who are undergoing stress, to irregularities in their menstrual patterns, to difficulties getting pregnant, to difficulties urinating, to difficulties with sexual function. These are all expressions of apana vayu becoming out of balance. So as we talk more about pathophysiology, the development of illness, we'll come back to this model of why apana, if you treat apana vayu, if you get apana moving downwards again, you'll often take care of a lot of problems that you wouldn't think were related. In fact, the reason that I'm here right now is that after going to a course on Ayurveda, I think in 1985, I was told that migraine headaches can sometimes be a reflection of an imbalance in apana vata, that I should start asking my patients with migraines, how regular are their bowels? And of course, as a neurologist, I never asked about anything below the neck. And one of my patients that I tried this on was a lady that I had been following for a couple years with recurrent migraines several times a week, and invariably every weekend, either I or one of my colleagues would get a call saying she had to go to the emergency room for a shot because she had intolerable migraine. And every time I knew that this lady was scheduled to see me, I'd see her name on the schedule the next day, I'd have this little kind of gripping sensation in my third chakra, because I couldn't do anything for her, despite multiple medications. And after hearing this talk on apana vata, I decided that I would ask her about her bowels, and sure enough, she told me that she had very irregular bowel habits, that she could go days at a time without ever going to the bathroom. So I said to her, well, let's try something different. Instead of changing your medication this time, let's just give you something to get your bowels moving every day and see what happens. She looked at me a little bit funny, but said, sure. So I put her on a natural bowel agent, and I remembered that about 3 weeks later, she was scheduled to see me. And when I saw that she was supposed to come in the next day, I got anxious because I realized that I hadn't heard from her in the whole time since I last saw her. And it's funny how interpretations can change, because previously I always kind of had this resistance to seeing her, but this time I thought, uh-oh, she went back to her primary physician, she told him what kind of a crazy recommendation I made, he told her he never wanted her to see me again, and from that point I would never receive any of his consultation referrals again. So I was actually, for the first time, worrying that I wasn't going to see her. She arrived, and I said, how come we haven't heard from you? She said, I've only had one headache in the last 3 weeks. and I was in total disbelief. I said, oh, come on. No, what are you doing? Did you finally leave your husband? She said, no, I've just been going to the bathroom every day. And like, it took me about 6 months to actually believe her. But it really demonstrated to me that there is this close linkage between Apanavata doing what it's supposed to be doing and the rest of the physiology. And then Dhyana, of course, is the circulation. So those are the five sub-doshas. Prana, mind and breath. Udana, expression and speech. Samana, digestive movement. Apana, downward movement, clearly the most important in terms of illness. And then Dhyana, circulating. There are five forms of pitta. Sataka, alochaka, pachaka, ranjaka, vrajaka. Okay. So this is the way that fire element expresses itself in our physiology. Sataka, again, it's that fire element that allows us to discriminate. You know, we all know people who are very intense and very discriminating. They will be able to argue any point. When sataka is balanced, it does its job appropriately. Meaning, you go to the grocery store, you say, oh, this green pepper looks great and fresh, this one doesn't look that great. But when sataka gets out of balance, when that fire element starts to get overheated, then it creates a sense of being critical, irritable, condemning, overly judgmental. And that's true for every one of these elements. It has a balanced state, and then if it gets aggravated, it will create imbalance, sense of discomfort, and ultimately illness. So sataka pitta is that which allows us to discriminate appropriately. Alochaka, again, is involved in that whole process of visual perception. Pachaka refers to the digestive fire. So it's what really allows us to break down food, extract the elements of nourishment that we need, and disregard the rest. Ranjaka is localized to the liver. And it's really responsible for detoxification, for imparting color to the blood. Ranjaka is the metabolic process of pitta that helps our body detoxify. So when we've been drinking too much alcohol or smoking, eating bad foods, the ranjaka pitta keeps firing and firing and firing and eventually either gets overwhelmed or creates a sense of toxicity in the system because we can't metabolize the toxins in our environment as quickly as we're ingesting them. And vrajaka pitta is localized in the skin. It governs the coloration of people. So the difference in color is a reflection of this vrajaka pitta. If it gets too activated, it creates skin rashes. It creates that red, irritable inflammation, fire, when it shouldn't be there. If you never see the sun, get very pale, you won't be able to metabolize the vitamin D that's necessary for building strong bones. So again, the right amount is what's essential to good health. And then finally, the five forms of kapha, tarpaka, bodhika, kledika, avalambika, and shlesika. Okay. So tarpaka refers to the cerebral spinal fluid. It's that cooling, nurturing fluid that circulates throughout the nervous system. Bodhika is this water element in the mouth. It has both digestive properties, cooling properties, allows us to taste. Kledika is the principle that governs the protective secretions of the stomach. So again, it's the mucus that lines the stomach, the digestive tract, that prevents the acid in the stomach from causing tissue damage. Avalambika is that which supports the heart, the lung, the spinal column. So you can think of it as the pericardial fluid that supports the heart, the pleural fluid that allows our lungs to expand and contract without rubbing up against the rib cages. It also is the fluid within the intervertebral discs that give us the support in our spine. So in each of these cases, there has to be the right amount of fluid. If we accumulate too much fluid, we can have serious problems, as when people get an infection on their heart lining, that fluid accumulates, causes dysfunction with the heart. If we lose the fluid, it can also cause problems, as what happens when we have a degenerative disc, get pain because that lubricating influence is no longer there. And then shlesika refers to the synovial fluid in the joints. By the time a disease manifests in Ayurveda to the point that we can actually perceive it through our senses, it always involves all three doshas. It's in the earlier stages of illness, which it can be more of a reflection of some individual dosha imbalance. So if someone is having anxiety and insomnia, that may just be a vata imbalance. But when that anxiety and insomnia leads to developing an ulcer, then it's almost always going to be an involvement of vata, pitta, and kapha. So again, each of these three doshas, it's not really that important that you know the specifics as much as just know the principles. Know the principles of where things move in the physiology. Where do we metabolize and use heat and light in the physiology? Where do we need structure and lubrication? And then we'll begin to apply these so we can see specifically how different people manifest different expressions of these. And we can identify when we're starting to go off balance so that we can recorrect that and prevent and treat illness before it develops into something too serious. Okay, don't worry if you're not digesting it entirely at this point, if your sattaka pitta is still laboring a little bit. It will become increasingly clear over the next few days, and by the time that this course is complete, you will be experts in using these terms as fluidly as you know your name.